Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello, once again, from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 294 for Wednesday, the 30th day of August, 2017. Today, part two of our conversation with Gilbert Sandler, teller of Baltimore Tales, the writer and host of Baltimore Stories on WYPR. He's 94 years old. For more than 30 years, he entertained and informed readers of the Sun with his Baltimore Glimpses column, with descriptions of the way things used to be in the city. Gil Sandler worked in advertising and public relations, and after his retirement from that career, he held a position for three decades at the Abel Foundation. Through all those years, he told stories, and he wrote books, all about the Baltimore he knew growing up, and as a young adult returning from service in the Navy in World War II. In part one of our conversation, Gil talked about being a kid in Park Heights during the Depression and in the years leading up to the war. He also told us about his Navy service in the Pacific and coming home to Baltimore after the war in 1945. That's where we'll pick up today, as Gil gives his views of Baltimore yesterday and today. The operative metaphor is the city as cuckoo clock with lots of moving parts. And we'll take a couple of amusing side trips to Old Orioles Park and the Club Charles. Gil believes he is the last Baltimorean alive to have seen Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis play at the Club Charles. How did you think people felt after World War II?
Tremendous optimism post-war.
Optimism.
Everybody had the sense that we couldn't get cars before. We're going to get cars now. Couldn't get a refrigerator. We had a refrigerator now. Couldn't get meat. All the meat you want. Couldn't get whiskey. We were in a whole new world was opening up.
Did you find a job?
Yeah, I did. I worked for an advertising agency for a while, full-time.
Uh-huh.
There was a boom. Everybody who woke up in the morning could make a living by the end of the day. You had to be lazy or indifferent or stupid. And it just came to you. You didn't have to be particularly smart or wise. Look at the telephone book and see all the startups in the businesses.
We're talking about the 1950s now?
1950s. Mm. Appliances, which were not made during the war, were suddenly every corner had an appliance store, refrigerator. In comes TV. Every corner store had TV.
So a lot of retail, a lot of competition, a lot of advertising.
Absolutely. Right? Everybody. You know.
So you were immersed in that world.
And we're immersed in that world, too, of course. But my heart always was with the stories.
So you always had a hand in journalism.
Always.
And writing stories.
Never stopped.
And this other hand in public relations and business.
Yeah. Exactly. Never stopped writing stories. You know all my editors.
I do, because by the time I got here, you were churning them out every week in the evening.
I had a
column
on the op-ed page for 35 years.
Right.
And we used to have a magazine, a Sun magazine. I did 3 out of 4 covers every month.
Yeah. I learned a lot from your pieces about what used to be here.
Yeah, well, thank you for that.
And speaking of that, you know, I know you feel that civic spirit that you have in your heart. You don't just live here and work here. You really care about the place. We didn't move away. I mean, we could have taken jobs.
Never moved to the county.
Yeah, never moved to the county. So when you look at all this history in Baltimore, all these decades that have gone by, you see lots of good and you see lots of bad. Sometimes it feels like the city's in a rut, a terrible rut it can't get out of. Other times you see a vista in the city. You see or talk to new people doing something interesting and entrepreneurial, and you say, this city's got so much going for it. You know, there's all this potential, it seems like, almost all the time with us, and a distance between the potential and the full reality.
Well, it's the cuckoo clock thing, you know, a cuckoo clock. A bird comes out of a... Yeah. He tweets, and then the bell goes off. And different things happen at different levels, all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're watching this cuckoo clock. It's all happening. You got to take it in and figure out what's happening here. Well, That's just the way...
It's complicated.
It's complicated. Everything's happening at the same time, and you got to figure out how it all comes together. Yes, there are many, many Baltimores. There are...
Well, you have to imagine the whole, don't you? Because if you just focus on the one thing, the negative, say it was homicides. I mean, we could obsess about that every day, every hour of every day, to where that becomes your picture of Baltimore, right? But that is a skewed picture because it leaves out everything else that's going on here in a day.
Well, I invite people who are in despair to go to some of the programs that are functioning, some of the fundraisers, and you see the dedication of the people and the lives and fortunes that they pledge to this. They're not kidding. I was at a function for the Pratt Library some months ago. Came time for an auction to raise money, yeah. I couldn't believe the amount of money people were willing to commit.
A bidding war of some kind?
Bidding war. Yeah. Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And they knew where it was going. It was going to the library for computers and books and personnel, whatever it took. Who uses the library? Well, poor people. So that's also in the cuckoo clock. That's also happening. Mm-hmm. There are people care deeply about the city and work hard for the city and try to understand it.
Well, you know what? For years we've been talking about what would it take to pull Baltimore up just another notch, hit a tipping point where more things are moving in a positive direction, where Baltimore is a more positive experience for more people. We know what those things are. We've identified those things for years, and it seems like we can't quite get there. Education, for one, public education.
It's very hard. I'm not a social scientist. That's the last thing I am. But I read a lot of what they say, and they often say we need to focus on building and holding families, mother, father, two children, little dog, you know, a family. Families, when they move into neighborhoods, are serious about their houses, and they pick up the trash. And families are serious about education, so they go to the PTA meetings. So the social scientists tell us we got to get these families strong.
So you're describing a nuclear family.
A nuclear family, yes.
So you think you're more likely to have success with that?
You say me.
Your thoughts after everything you've
that
read.
That I read, yeah. I'm impressed with that. Yeah. I think that's a very reasonable approach. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, see, that requires people, a social engineering
how do you convince people not to be a single parent?
But
I do read that with interest, and looks to me that when I think back on my own neighborhood, we were poor, or close to poor, not poverty by any means, but certainly poor. We owned our own home. I'll never forget my little mother, could barely speak English. She goes out in the street one day, she sees a young man tossing a popsicle wrapper on the street. And she said, "Young man, this is Cottage Avenue. We don't drop our popsicle. Pick that up." Mm-hmm. He did. She knew her family cared deeply about where we live, and we didn't want trash on the street. So there's something to recognize when they say this, that it would be salubrious for the city. You talked about what we can do and what is there a magic bullet? No. But this is one of the things that I'm impressed with.
It seems to me like the city has an opportunity to grab a generation of young people who want to live in cities, who think cities are cool. But you got to get them past the fears they might have about living in the city. And Baltimore, is it kind of a tough sell right now?
It is, but there are so many positives. It's a matter of, I guess, gathering the facts. I noticed the other day that recruiting for the Baltimore City schools are going out into the streets and school to school and school and retreating.
Yeah, door to door.
I went to Baltimore City College, as you know, and we started a debate program for people who, what are you talking about? Today, 10 years later, thanks to support from the Abel Foundation, it's one of the recognized debate programs in the country.
Because it's a source of pride for you.
Well, it is.
When you go to these debates, you see the city team versus what? A Poly team or a team from another state?
No, not Poly. I mean, Poly with all due respect to Poly guys, we eat you for breakfast.
What's a strong debate competitor?
Well, the a National Catholic Forensic League provides a competition from the Catholic schools. They're very good debaters.
Okay, so when you see...
Once you start me on this, can't interrupt me. We also go to... we send these kids to college campuses, Yale, Harvard, Penn, Emory University, to debate with the best there is in the country. And we've had kids place eighth or ninth in the country. It's kids who've never been out of West Baltimore.
So how do you feel when you're sitting there listening to them?
Very proud, very proud. We went almost all the way with our mock trial team. Almost all the way. We went to the state finals. We were second. Can you believe that? Gil, I won't tell you the private schools we beat because I don't want to embarrass them.
Gil, how did you decide on this, on putting your efforts and some money into debating?
I had a call one day from City College. They had a board of visitors looking after the school had reopened in the Schaefer years. Remember, he closed it and then reopened, and it was floundering. So some alumni got together and said, we got to do something about saving our school. And they called me and said, why don't you join the board of visitors? And what can we do? And I said, well, one of the things you can do is bring back the debate program. I wasn't a very good debater myself, but City had a very good debate team, nationally recognized for it. And Bob Embry gave me money for 5 years and said, if you can do it in 5 years, you got a program. We did it.
And it's been how many?
15 years.
15 years now.
They started what is known as the Gil Sandler Fund. Those of you who would like to contribute. No, I won't. I won't do that. I won't take advantage of you. But the Gil Sandler Fund supports it. And it's a jewel in the city. The kinds of programs that families come to see it. You know, it brings glory to the city, to the school, to the families. It's these kinds of things still go on. So you can't say we're out of luck. There's a lot of things going on.
You have to look at the whole picture.
It's the cuckoo clock.
There's a lot of things going on. And you know what else that occurred to me? This is a thought I had that maybe I'll write about someday. We just had this ceasefire operation in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And, you know, people went out in the street and they made an effort to get the word out. We don't want you shooting or killing anyone for these next 4 days. And they made the effort. Of course, you know, there were still shootings and
I think
fatalities.
There were two of them.
Yeah. But they made the effort. And it occurred to me that living in Baltimore takes some effort. If you're a citizen, you have to go a little bit extra than you would in any other city where you could just sit on your rear end and let the city take care of itself. It takes a little bit more patience, effort. Certainly, patience.
And you have to have some sense of the mindset of people who like cities. We're different people. We're different people. High hedges are disruptive if you live in the city. Mm-hmm. They may protect you in the county, you know.
Right.
But in the city, I mean, we don't have high hedges. We have a lot of steps. You sit on the steps.
Right.
Know, I grew
it
up.
It takes effort. You have to.
You have to be
willing to live with other people.
Exactly. You have to understand the clashes that go on.
And there's a lot of diversity.
Deal with that.
When you have diversity, you have a lot of different voices. And
out of that come really great ideas and great life and great music, great ideas, great businesses. But there is this thing, it's quite real, I understand it, has to do with fear. Read about these murders.
Yeah.
How many people say, well, I could go, but wasn't there a murder there 2 weeks ago, or things mm-hmm. like that?
Mm-hmm.
It does happen. You have to be willing to...
Well, that's why we need, one of the reasons why we need to get this under control. First, to save lives. Secondly, it harms the city's psyche. And then for people who don't live here, who think about living here or visiting here, it's harmful in that way, too. It's not just public relations. We are talking about real lives here.
How many college students give up applying here? I understand that it's a number of some significance. So we have our problems, but at the same time, there's this cuckoo clock. That bird is singing.
Yeah.
Remember that?
We had a front page story about a hydroponic garden inside an old shipping container.
I saw that.
Yeah. I went over there to visit it myself. Yeah. Actually, I told some we should do a story about this. I didn't do it myself. But I went inside this thing. It's behind the Old American Brewery. And it's amazing. And there's these young guys who are going to be able to grow lettuce and herbs all year round and feed restaurants and institutions and their own food stall in our house in Remington. And so you walk away from something like that and you say, oh, my God, this city.
Remington makes the point.
Yeah, sort of.
You
does.
go through Remington, and people are moving in there. They're converting factories into houses. There's life in Remington beyond blue collar jobs, and the same is true all over downtown Canton. Listen, I can remember Canton when you just didn't go there. It's nothing but factories and industry Canton today.
And I remember Canton, well, you probably remember this too, when the highway was supposed to go through.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of row houses were torn down in anticipation of a federal highway, interstate highway going through there.
We have made some mistakes. Yeah. We have made some mistakes. Yeah. We're not without mistakes. If you look at our history, you can see mistakes we're living with to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You have to realize we're not perfect people, are we?
No, but if I was a young person and doing it all over again, I would come here.
Young people are coming here. Look, what's the busiest zip?
It's downtown, isn't it?
Yeah. Downtown's the busiest zip.
Yeah.
There's activity downtown. All those old office buildings are being converted into apartments. Who's moving into them? Young people.
I know.
Right.
And we drive around, we see cranes. And then, you know, I've written about this. You've read my columns where I say, here I am enjoying this amazing vista of this new Baltimore. And then, you know, an hour later, we hear about a shooting and a homicide. It's like, come on, let's move on. Let's do something about this. Right?
Well,
more Baltimoreans need to take part in the good part of Baltimore and the thriving part of Baltimore.
Well, you know, a lot has to do, we should have mentioned this earlier if we're going to talk about the city. We lost a lot of industry in the very 50s that you're talking about. You remember National Beer, and all that? That was a blue-collar anthem. I remember when I was doing some work for the Sun on neighborhoods, I went to Highland Town, 7 o'clock in the morning, coming off the shifts. Everybody was working in the Chevrolet shift, father and son, grandson, everybody was working. We had all that industry. When we lost it, we made an attempt, an honest attempt, to replace it with tourism. That's why we built Harbor Place and the Science Center, all the National Aquarium. The great, great institutions. It's not the same. It doesn't provide the same.
And you know,
families lived on this.
Yeah.
You go to Hollywood.
Yeah. You can get to the middle class with jobs down at the Point.
Yeah,
and there's other
companies. Point, people would talk about that.
So that to me was a seismic change in Baltimore. The loss of manufacturing, and I get comments sometimes on Facebook and in the mail that you've had Democratic leadership in Baltimore for 50 years or more, and that's why Baltimore is a mess. And then someone actually the other day said, and look at the loss of jobs at Sparrows Point. I said, well, wait a minute. Actually, Sparrows Point is in Baltimore County. But still, you're blaming politicians for the loss of – local politicians for the loss of the manufacturing. This has been going on for 50 years. You know, this is not a new trend. But that's such a big thing. Well, it's such a big part of why Baltimore faltered during this period.
Do not underestimate the power of our local industries. We had the second or third largest center for the manufacture of men's and women's clothing in the world.
Downtown.
In the world. Downtown. It was said in America in the 1950s, no matter where you lived, your underwear, your coat, your shoes, whatever, was made in Baltimore. We lost all that. Mm. That had to do with giant shifts in retailing and manufacturing and globalization. I remember just a small story that Anne Arundel strawberries were a big deal in Baltimore. Anne Arundel strawberries. And the Polish community used to move down there.
Right, they would pick the strawberries.
Yeah, yeah, right, pick strawberries,
people doing that.
They had jobs doing that. Anyway.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that they invented something called the refrigerator truck. And they discovered they could buy those strawberries in Georgia and truck them up here cheaper than they could. There went jobs, you know.
All right.
Giant shifts in how things were made and sold also contributed to who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Rust Belt cities all over America are trying to deal with it in one way or another, some with some success, some with none, some with a lot. I guess we're somewhere.
Well, when you think about all this history, the confluence of two things, the loss of industry, the loss of so much population, white flight from the city, those are big setbacks, and it's not surprising that it's taking a long time to recover from it. Is it? Really?
Well,
I mean, the city's tried different things.
Well,
but
we're still trying. I mean, people are trying very, very hard.
I call Baltimore the city of perpetual recovery.
We had this big conference of experts here the other day.
City Lab.
I was hoping that they would present some ideas that were working in other cities, but I didn't see that. Maybe you did. What they came up with was money. We're happy to get that.
Right.
But I didn't see the ideas that I thought that's why they were coming together here to do that. I was a little disappointed.
Yeah. I think Baltimore can benefit from best practices elsewhere brought
here.
Yeah,
and I thought that's what that was. Hmm. But, hey, it's a hard thing to do, and you didn't have me on this show to give you the answers because I don't have them. I bleed Baltimore, as they say. I don't know why that is exactly. I love its traditions. And
you like its quirkiness?
Its quirkiness. I remember a lot of things that enriched my life. I remember I went to baseball games at 29th and Greenmount, right?
Old Oriole Park.
Old Oriole Park. And I must tell you that I never paid to get in. We boys learned how to dig under the fence to get in. So they put policemen watching that. So then we went over it. And finally they said, tell you what, guys, you're now in the knothole gang. Welcome.
So you knock a hole where there was a knot and watch the game through
It was named after them. They let us in. We had seats. Yeah. They couldn't stop
they
us.
They couldn't stop
They took credit. Hey, we're letting you in free. We were getting in free anyway. So we walked in and, you know, we never paid for anything.
Were you there when it caught on fire?
No, I was during the war. That was July 1944.
Oh, you were in the Pacific.
I was in the Pacific.
Oh, okay. So they can't blame you for that.
Can't blame me for that.
Who's the most famous person you ever met? Cab Calloway?
Yeah, I did meet him. Yeah, I guess he was very famous.
I interviewed him out at Pimlico, and he was, you know, betting on the horses.
Oh,
he loved the horses.
Yeah. He really did. I have to think about that. I met and talked with governors and mayors, and I guess they're famous people also.
Not Martin and Lewis at the old Hippodrome?
No, they were at the Club Charles.
Oh,
I don't believe
me.
They ever played the Hippodrome. Get it right.
Dean Martin right. And Jerry Lewis played the Club Charles?
And the Chanticleer, yes.
Okay.
And the owner, whose name was Lou Baumel, said to me in answer to my question, what do you pay these guys? Because they were nothing. Nobody's. He said, well, I pay Jerry Lewis $15. And what about Dean Martin? He says, well, I pay him 20. And why is that? Well, he could sing a little.
Gil.
But it's my privilege to have seen all that and remember him as what is known as Baltimore Stories, which I still delight in putting together and airing them, and it's fun to do that.
Can you think of a moment from your life, from downtown, a big event, or even a small event, just something that's so memorable to you from your own experience? Geez, I remember the parade when the Orioles won the World Series way back in 83. I remember the Ravens.
Way back in 83. That's yesterday.
Yeah. To me, it seems like a long time ago now.
No.
But, you know, when the Ravens won the Super Bowl.
I precede the Ravens.
Yeah.
I mean, they come late in my life.
You were here when the Orioles came to town from St. Louis,
that's
right?
That's right. I mean,
when they built Memorial Stadium.
Woody Abernathy, he was a home run hitter for the Baltimore Orioles in 1936.
Oh, you going
36,
back then.
Oh, sure.
Excuse me, those are the old Orioles.
The old Orioles. They were the Orioles. I did interview a famous guy from the Orioles, Chuck, what was his name? He was a second baseman. And I said to him.
You mean from the old Orioles? Back in the 30s?
And I looked him up.
I can't help you there.
I said, where were you the night the park burned down? He said, I was home asleep. I said, well, how'd you know about the fire? He said, well, we got a call from the coach who's a manager, Chuck Armstrong. He said, I got bad news for you. What's the bad news? The park burned down. We don't have a team anymore. We don't have a place to play. He said, that's great. He said, why do you say that? He says, I'm having a lousy year. Can't think of his name.
He was a second baseman?
A second baseman.
You think his name was Chuck, but the manager was Chuck?
Armstrong.
Armstrong?
Yeah. remember, this stuff was a long time ago. Blasmonico.
Oh, my
Blasmonico.
God. His name was Chuck Blasmonico?
No, it was not Chuck. It was Blas, B-L-A-S, Monaco.
Oh, his first name was Blas.
I think he played second base.
Blasmonico?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Only Gil Sandler could come up with a name like that.
That wasn't my idea.
Well, I'm going to look for it.
Monaco. You'll look for it. There was a sad moment. Can I tell you about a sad moment?
Sure.
Sun Square. Does that mean anything to you? Sun Square.
Wasn't that the corner of Charles and Balmer Street?
What was there?
The Baltimore Sun building.
Sun.
Right? Yeah.
Remember, I was knocking around the Sun papers in the 1938, 39 with odd jobs. So get jobs running proof to advertisers. And everything important centered on Times Square. If there was a parade.
You mean Sun Square.
Sun Square. Mm-hmm. Sun Square. If there was a parade, start at Sun Square. Everybody knew where that was. When the war ended, when the war ended, everybody went down to Sun Square. Of course.
That's where the news was.
And one day, the sun moved out of Sun Square to Calvert Street.
Where we are today.
Where you are today. Where we're sitting right now.
They moved from a central location in the city.
To something on North Calvert Street. Yeah. Nobody went to North Calvert Street. And they took away a lot of memories and history. I remember sitting on the steps of the Savings Bank of Baltimore right across the street. Building's still there.
Yep.
And the sun had rigged up some kind of board, a baseball board. And lights moved across. A guy got a hit, and you'd see the light moving along the first base.
Oh, so you could follow a game?
You could follow it. I think it was the World Series in particular. Up on the wall. Sun Square, up on the wall. Man, who does anything like that today? Up on the wall. And we sat there all afternoon watching the World Series.
That's pretty cool.
Sun Square.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it? I see photographs.
Lost all of that, see?
I see photographs, and I think we missed something there. And why did they move to Calvert Street? Do you know why we moved here?
Why? You would know more about that than I do.
I don't know.
I really don't know. I remember they moved on Christmas Day, 1952, or something like that.
Hmm.
And it was very sad to me because the institutional memories of the city were there.
To identify where that became the Morris Mechanic Theater. That location.
Yes.
And now that's gone, and there's something new going in there now, a skyscraper. Right. Yeah.
And Sun Square was just, and it was more than a newspaper, you know. You walked in the lobby at Sun Square in that building the night before, that'd be Saturday night, to see the want ads for the next day. I saw people do that so they could get an advance on an apartment that was for rent before home delivery on Sunday morning. People did that. Came into the lobby. It was just a way of life. Everything happened at Sun Square. That was a lot to lose in city life, I thought, at least for me.
And also, you think about all the advances in communications technology that keep people from being with other people.
Yeah.
I mean, we're with each other remotely a lot, but not so much, shoulder to shoulder, looking over someone's shoulder at the help wanted ads in a newspaper. You know, you don't need to do that anymore.
Another story for the social scientists, right?
Yeah, okay.
But that's a memorable moment. It was sad, and I don't pass Baltimore Charles today.
Without thinking of that, yeah.
There are pictures during a war of Sun Square, and they've got bags of sand against all the windows in the sky, because they knew if anybody's going to bomb us, they're going to hit Sun Square and knock out the paper. That's it. That was the nerve center of the city.
It's interesting to see how the nerve center of the city moved. Now someone would say it's Pratt and Light. Others would say maybe it's over in Harbor East now.
I almost went crazy about a year ago. I saw a sign come up at Baltimore, at Calvert and Lombard. A sign went up. And on it, it said, downtown, and it pointed an arrow. Downtown? It's not downtown. Somebody decided that was downtown. It's not downtown. Downtown's where people came together and different ideas, and there was trafficking and retailing and wholesaling and manufacturing and entertainment and restaurants. That was downtown.
I wonder if we'll see that again.
I hope so.
Born and raised in Baltimore, Gilbert Sandler's stories have been published in The Sun. For years, he wrote the Baltimore Glimpses feature in the Old Evening Sun. He also wrote for the Jewish Times and Baltimore Magazine, and he served as editor of Generations, the Journal of the Jewish Museum of Maryland. He is the author of several books, including Jewish Baltimore, A Family Album, Small Town Baltimore, and Homefront Baltimore. He is the writer and host of Baltimore Stories on WYPR. Oh, and Blas Monaco, he was a longtime minor league player who played in the 1930s and 1940s. He had a couple of seasons with the old International League Baltimore Orioles and played 17 major league games in two different brief stints, one in 1937, one in 1946, with the Cleveland Indians. He had a total of two hits in 13 at-bats. And that's our show for now. For producer Steve Early, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.